Eureka! I found it, and it is totally awesome. I am the first one to complain about the overuse of the word awesome, but what I want to speak about today is truly awesome. So what did I find awesome? For the first time, I believe I have scientific evidence that God cares. I always talk in terms of two leaps of faith associated with being religious. Leap of faith number one is the question, is there a God? And by this question, I'm talking about an organizing intelligence in the universe. And I'm going to discuss evidence for the existence of God that I find most compelling. But question number two is a more difficult question. And that question is, does God care? Does God care whether I am kind to babies or torture them? Does God care whether I or you come to services today on Rosh Hashanah? Does God care whether we have turkey or ham for lunch today? Why am I so interested in these questions? Well, because I was first a physicist. And so many people think science and religion are incompatible, so I can't resist offering some quick observations. I love the example of coming down in the morning and seeing a tea kettle boiling and asking the question, why is the tea kettle boiling? And it turns out there are two reasons. Number one is all the physics and thermodynamics of heating water. But number two is because Sonia wanted tea. Now, we don't have to ask the question of which one of those answers is correct. They can both obviously be correct. So when we ask the question, why is there a universe? There are also two possible answers. One is cosmology and everything that physics teaches us. And the second is because God wanted a universe. I love the quote of Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of Great Britain, who said, "Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean." Some people say God speaks two languages, Hebrew and calculus, and I am privileged to have studied both. I've given talks and classes on science and religion here in Ojai and elsewhere, and in fact was just invited to speak to a 14,000 strong gathering of Catholic youth about this subject in March. My goal is to show people of science and rational thought that there is nothing irrational about religion, and to show people of faith that they don't diminish their faith by accepting completely the teachings of science. There are lots of reasons to believe that there is some order and guidance to the universe. The idea is to consider how amazing it is that we actually have a universe which allows for life. And basically, the way to analyze this is there are a number of physical constants. You know, we have the force of gravity. But the strength of the force of gravity is not inherent in the laws of physics. It's just what we find it to be. So consider, if gravity was a little bit stronger, the Big Bang would be immediately followed by a big crunch. No universe. If gravity were a little bit weaker, and we're only talking about a few percent, the universe would consist entirely of dust. No stars, no planets, no elements. We also have the force of attraction between positive and negative charges. So in an atom, you have electrons charged negatively whizzing around the nucleus charged positively. But it turns out the electromagnetic constant also is just right, so that these atoms share their electrons. If the electromagnetic constant were a little bit stronger, atoms would not share their electrons, and we'd have no compounds. We'd have hydrogen, we'd have oxygen, but no water. If the constant were a bit weaker, we would only have gaseous plasmas. Again, nothing that could sustain life. The shape of the Earth's orbit and its distance from the sun is just perfect to support life. Planets orbiting their stars orbit in ellipses, which are oblong. But Earth's orbit is almost perfectly circular, far more circular than any other planet, which allows for life because we don't go through extremes of heat and cold. We on Earth have a big brother in Jupiter, a massive planet whose gravitation has cleared out the asteroids and keep them from colliding with us. But in fact, there was a collision millions and millions of years ago that created the moon, a collision of an asteroid that ejected a huge mass of molten material and created the moon. That collision gave the Earth a molten core that causes a magnetic field, what works our compasses, to exist in the center of the Earth. And this is the first time I've ever done this, but I am having visual aids for this sermon. So here's the first. These are the Northern Lights. And I think that may even be me. I went to Churchill, Manitoba, where the temperatures got to an actual 40 degrees below zero. And it turns out when it's 40 degrees below zero, you don't have to ask if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, because they are actually the same. Well, they're the same at about 29 below zero. And the Earth's magnetic field extends into space and protects the Earth from cosmic radiation from the solar wind. If we didn't have this magnetic field protecting us, our atmosphere would be a lot like the atmosphere of Mars, namely gone, because the solar wind would strip the atmosphere. So instead, the magnetic field of the Earth focuses this interaction to the poles. And this actually is a visible example and a visual rendering of the hand of God protecting the Earth. Awesome. The odds that an anthropic universe exists, I'm going to mention a number that is incomprehensible on many levels. It's 10 to the 10th to the 132nd power. If you take all the various possibilities of these constants and you just spell them out, the odds that we live in a universe that could support life is such a large number that to express the number, it would be one followed by enough zeros so that the number itself to be written would take up a substantial portion of the universe. A wonderful quote from Einstein is that the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. And by the way, now we're in a universe, we have a world, we have chemicals, we have stuff. What's the likelihood that life forms? In order to have life, you need DNA. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. It was discovered about 60 or 70 years ago. And although we've known exactly what DNA, its shape and its constituent parts, no one has been able to reproduce a DNA molecule, a DNA strand, in the laboratory. So what's the likelihood that it happened spontaneously? And we know it happened almost instantly in geologic time once the Earth cooled enough to allow it to form. So one of my friends, a physicist in Westlake Village, wrote a book called Can Life Merely Be an Accident? And he expresses the probability in the following way. He says that, imagine I'm asking you to pick an ace of spades from a deck of cards. The odds against doing it perfectly the first time is 1 in 52. If you want to do it, if I say do it twice in a row, it's not good enough. The odds are 1 in 52 squared, like 2,500 to 1. If I say that's not good enough, do it 5 times in a row, now we're in the 30 to 40 million to 1 likelihood. The odds that DNA spontaneously formed as quickly as it did is equivalent to pulling that ace of spades from a deck of cards 118,000 times in a row. So for me, the question of does God exist, is there organization to the universe, is an easy one. Now the question is, does God care? If God cares, presumably God communicates God's caring. It's what we call revelation. So we get to the question of what happened at Sinai. And we also should understand, in trying to analyze this, I would say something happened at Sinai, but humans wrote it down. And psychologists teach us that 90% of what we observe is conditioned by our culture. So, you know, you have witnesses to the same event and they come away with very different stories. So again, something happened, but our expectations influence what we said. Also, from the world of physics, something happened, but we can only detect a very small part of the electromagnetic spectrum. If the whole electromagnetic spectrum was equivalent to 3,000 miles, we know it goes from very short wavelengths, particles and so on, to very long wavelengths, gravitational waves. The part of the spectrum we can see is a very small part I often ask people to guess, and they will guess a mile, you know, a foot, an inch. It's smaller than the diameter of a hydrogen atom. So out of 3,000 miles, the part we can see is equivalent to the size of the smallest atom. So I take Torah very seriously, but I don't take it literally. When people ask me about this, I often ask the question, I'll ask you the question, how many of you have heard of the story of the boy who cried wolf? Did it really happen? And people might speculate. And I say, suppose I could prove to you that it never happened. Would that affect the significance and the importance of the story? And of course, the answer is no. The significance of the story of the boy who cried wolf is not in its historicity, but in the lesson that it teaches. And that's how I understand Torah. I have science and physics textbooks, and they are typically obsolete in 5 or 10 years. But the Torah is at least 3,000 years old and still as vital and significant as it was on the day it was given. So I love to read Torah in two ways. One, through the eyes of the rabbis who take every word as literally the word of God and extract meanings out of it. So, for example, when God asks Cain about his brother Abel that he just murdered, after Cain says, I don't know, am I my brother's keeper? God says, your brother's blood cries out to me. But this is never translated as an extra little yud in the word blood, and it actually reads, your brother's bloods cry out to me, plural. So the rabbis extract the teaching that if you take one life, it's as though you killed an entire world. The bloods, the plural bloods, are all the children that Abel will now never have. And if you save a life, you save an entire world. There are those of us that have doubts about God's existence and God's caring. I think that's what God wants us to have. We call our people Yisrael, we who struggle with God. I often say if we had perfect faith, then we would lose our freedom. You know, it actually happened to me, I think, driving home yesterday, zipping along the 101 at the new official speed length of 72.5 miles an hour. You start overtaking a highway patrol car, and I, like everyone else, slows down to 64 miles an hour. Why? In theory, I have free will to go zipping by him. In practice, I know I'm going to get a ticket, or I might very probably get a ticket. So if we had perfect knowledge of God, we would be like someone driving with a highway patrolman sitting in the passenger seat with his ticket book out. We would know we would be rewarded and punished. By having some doubts, we are free to obey or disobey. Human free will. I often point to the generation of the Exodus. They saw amazing miracles. They saw 10 plagues in Egypt. They saw the sea split. They got manna in desert. If anybody you think would have perfect faith, it would be those folks. But Moses is one day late coming down from the mountain, and the people say to Moses' brother Aaron, the high priest, for crying out loud, to make a golden calf to worship. So if those people couldn't have perfect faith, how much more difficult is it for us? So I believe that God cares. And of course, that raises questions about evil and tragedy. And as I discussed last night, evil is the result of free will, and tragedy is the result of God intervening, God not intervening, in the physics of the world. God cares but doesn't intervene. So what good is God? God is a teacher and an inspirer. Teaches, even demands, even commands that we do the right thing. If we live up to this, then God is present in our world. Our lives are better. The lives of others are better. There's a midrash on Isaiah. Isaiah quotes God as saying, I am God and you are my witnesses. And so the rabbis dig into this sentence and say, what did God really mean by that strange statement? I am God and you are my witnesses. And the rabbis conclude that if we are not God's witnesses, then God might as well not be God. If we don't act in this world in God's name, then God is essentially irrelevant. For me, Dayenu, that's enough. Then I went to see the eclipse. And I want to show you a photo from the eclipse. I'll show you the photo. This is a composite photo. So this got me interested in the question of whether from science there's any evidence of God's caring. And I started thinking about this because someone once said to me, look at a flower, how beautiful is it? That's a proof of God's gift and God's love to us. And I smiled rabbinically and said, yes, but in my scientific heart, I know flowers are beautiful for good Darwinian reasons about pollination and survival of species. So I didn't get it from flowers. And then I went to the eclipse. It had been on my bucket list to see a total eclipse. Research led me to Madras, Oregon as being the best place to see an eclipse, the lowest likelihood of cloud cover. Those who know me won't be surprised that I made hotel reservations 2.5 years in advance. Some of you might be surprised to learn that when we were on the flight, things were so overbooked that Delta was offering $4,000 a seat for people to voluntarily leave. And I was very proud of my wife for not kicking me. Because we stayed on, and we might have been able to make it a day later, but I did not even want to take a chance on missing it. There were fears and warnings of traffic jams and gas and water shortages and food shortages. Turns out everybody got there before we did. The traffic was almost nil. We hit no problems, but we did pass an enormously large field of people camping out in tents and trailers. It was astounding. So the morning of the eclipse, of course, I'm up early. I'm very excited. I'm actually jumping out of my skin excited. And right outside our motel window is a group of nerds, of eclipse chasers. You might call them a Google of nerds, I guess would be the technical term. And for one of them, this was his 8th total eclipse. And his first two were clouded out. Can you imagine traveling halfway around the world for an eclipse? And you get the same effect by closing your eyes because it was really cloudy. There were people with telescopes and binoculars with solar filters. The guy who took this photograph had a tremendous telescope. And every time he clicked the shutter, it actually took 9 different exposures with different shutter speeds. So the result would be as perfect as it turned out to be. The most astounding thing, and this sort of explores it. So I think, yeah, this is the way it came. So here's the sun, and later, I hope some of you come up and look, you can actually see the sunspots in this photograph. The moon is just closing, and it's perfect. It fits perfectly. And then you have what's called the diamond ring effect, because the sun, just before totality, is peeking through some craters on the moon. And so you get one gloriously shining spot. The pictures don't do it justice. But even with a little bit of light, it's still light out. I mean, you could see the change in sunlight, but it's still pretty light. And then instantly, it's night. The light of the corona is equivalent, this photographer told me, with the light of a full moon. So instantly, you have this absolutely amazing evening, and the corona, again, this doesn't do it justice, is just blazing in the sky. It was magnificent. People are cheering. I am praying. And I couldn't stop saying, oh, wow. So beautiful, so fragile, a moment of holy stillness after people stopped cheering. In totality, another reason Madras was so good is in the center of the pass of totality, so a little over 2 minutes. So I said, the word awesome is overused, but this was truly awesome. It made me think of other awesome moments in my life. My very first trip to Israel, I got into Jerusalem late at night and didn't make it to the Western Wall until midnight. And for one incredible moment, I was alone at the Kotel at the Western Wall. A few years later, my first year in rabbinical school, Sonia was visiting me in Jerusalem. And for a much longer than a moment, she and I were inside the Dome of the Rock, inside the rock, which in Jewish mystical tradition is called the Evan HaShtiyah, the place where God actually created the universe. So she and I were alone with each other, literally at the center of the universe. Another incredibly awesome moment for me was when I got to give a benediction at the House of Representatives from the same spot where the president gives the State of the Union address. And then in an instant, the sun reappeared, another diamond ring effect. So it's going this way. And everyone starts starting cars and leaving. I couldn't believe it, because there's another hour of eclipse left. And this was Sonia's favorite moment, because she said she was really excited that the sun was coming back. And echoing, you know, what ancient people who thought maybe a dragon had eaten the sun. And my response was to scream, "One more time!" And that got a few laughs. So as I mentioned, there's no inherent reason in physics we should be able to see the corona. It happens because the sun is exactly 400 times larger than the moon, and the sun is 400 times further away from the Earth than is the moon. The angular diameter of both in the sky is about half a degree. Can you hold this for me? I have spared no expense to offer the following demonstration. Jeff? Okay, so here is the sun. We're using a scale. I told you to wear gloves. We are using a scale of 1 foot equals 1,000,000 miles. The sun is about 93 million miles away. So take the sun 93 million miles away. Now, I actually want those of you able to get up, leave the doors open, please, Jeff, and see how far 93 million miles is on a scale of 1 foot equals 1,000,000 miles. Okay, that's about where it is. So I just want you to see the geometry of this for a second. Let me move this aside. I want you to get the geometry of what's going on here. Here is my highly expensive, detailed model of the moon's orbit around the Earth. On this scale, the moon's orbit is about 3 inches. There's the Earth. On this scale, the Earth is about the size of a tip of a Crayola crayon. The moon's diameter is equivalent to 0.6 millimeter, or the thinnest lead you can find in a mechanical pencil. Actually, this hole is a little bigger than the actual diameter. So just think about it a while. There's the sun, and here's the moon circling the Earth. And the orbits can go this way and that way, but every now and again, it lines up perfectly. Okay, Jeff, you can come back in. I may have this again. By the way, on this scale, I want you all to heave a sigh of relief, because on September 1st, an asteroid passed 4.5 feet, about 4.4 million miles from the Earth. But on this scale, the size of the asteroid was about the size of a bacterium. So it was pretty small. And of course, the Earth is rotating in this huge circle around the sun. And we're also rotating around the center of the Milky Way. So I would have asked Jeff to go and stand where the center of the Milky Way is, but that's actually about where Saturn is in our planetary system. And by the way, the nearest sun, the nearest star to the Earth is about the distance to London on this scale. So why am I making you all so crazy with this? I believe that the perfection of the solar eclipse is a sign that God cares. Sure, it could be a coincidence, but you know, apologize for this, the total eclipse was actually necessary in order for us to understand the nature of the universe and the theory of general relativity. Einstein had a very strange prediction. He predicted that gravity actually changes the structure of space. And as a result, light should be bent by gravitational fields. So here we are with this little, you know, with this little top, and there's the sun all the way down there, and there are star fields. Oh, here's a star field. And just notice this. There are star fields, and we know where the stars are, right? But during the daytime, we can't see them. But during an eclipse, it's night. So we can see these stars and their relationship between them, including the ones that are very close to the sun. And Einstein predicted that the starlight should be bent. How much? 1.75 arcseconds. An arcsecond is 1/60th of 1/60th of a degree. 1.75 arcseconds would be equivalent to a right triangle with a height of 1 inch and a base about 2 miles. Very, very small angle. That's the deflection. In 1918, there were sent 2 expeditions to photograph the solar eclipse. One in an island off the coast of Africa and one to Brazil, just in case it was cloudy in either place. This was in May of 1919. It took until September for the photographic plates to be developed and the measurements done, and November until the results were announced. And lo and behold, Einstein was exactly right. They asked him, "What would your have reaction been, Professor Einstein, had the experiment proved you wrong?" And I quote, he said, "Then I would have felt sorry for the dear Lord, because I know that the theory is correct." There is no reason for the beauty and the gift of scientific knowledge that is inherent in the eclipse, except that God cares. My bottom line is that we are surrounded by miracles and by signs. I love to talk about the Midrash. I'm sure I've spoken about it before. There is a Midrash, a rabbinic story about the splitting of the sea. We all kind of have our vision of what this is. But the Midrash tells of two guys, I don't know, Shlomo and Yitzhak. And they're schlepping through the sea. The sea is split, and they got their heads literally in the mud. And they're saying, "Mud, mud, mud." We're following this guy, Moses, and things don't get any better. It's just a sticky, disgusting mud. Oh, it got my sandal caught in it. Nothing good ever happens to us. We go from thirst to mud. It's just messy. They completely missed the miracle, the Midrash says. They missed it because their heads were literally in the mud. Their eyes were in the mud. We are surrounded by miracles. We are surrounded by miracles and signs. Look at your finger. Your finger is surrounded by skin, the most amazing organ. It's the largest organ in the human body. It has temperature controls. It has sensory controls. Every cell of your body has DNA in it, and every strand of DNA are little correction machines running up and down the DNA, correcting mistakes. You know, you cut yourself and it heals. Try cutting your tire and see if it heals. We are surrounded by miracles. We just need to sometimes force ourselves to get our heads out of the mud to see them. We are living in the miracle of a time when we in this room have more than enough food, clothing, healthcare information, and the ability to enjoy them. These are miracles. These miracles, these gifts require acknowledgement. Just like your mother taught you, you get a gift, you send a thank you card. God doesn't need our thank you cards. God needs us to take care of each other. That's the way we acknowledge and thank God for the incredible miracles that surround us. Adonai, dear God, open our eyes to the miracles and gifts that you have showered upon us. Teach us awareness, teach us awe, and most of all, teach us gratitude and the responsibilities that come with it. Teach us to respond to the Shana Tova Umetuka, the good and sweet year that we hope we will be receiving, with generosity to share it with those whose year may not be so good or so sweet. Ken Yehi Ratzon, may this be God's will. Amen. Believe it or not, we are, Debbie, you have a few more words for us. And we are moving close to the conclusion of the service.
Addressing you, but she has been her 100-year-old father. She Spending these days together praying and reflecting, we hope to gain the